Every year, the New Yorker's Nick Pomengarten has a standing assignment to write a story about journeys. And this year, he decided to write about a journey you take standing, the short trip up and down in an elevator. His research placed him into a fascinating world of skyscrapers, elevator therapy, and the arcane art of elevatoring. We'll explain in a minute. If there's something you've always wanted to know about elevators but were afraid to ask, or if you have an elevator story for us, give us a call. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Nick Pomengarten is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and he joins us from our bureau in New York. And thanks very much for coming in today.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on.
And you sandwich your story about your piece around the story of Nicholas White, a man who was trapped in an elevator for 41 hours.
Yeah, poor Nicholas White went out for a cigarette break one night while working at Business Week. He was a production manager there. He went and had a cigarette, got back into the elevator, and the thing stopped. And he spent the next 41 hours, a full weekend in an elevator by himself.
An event that we eventually find out changed his life.
It did. Nick White holds that it wasn't so much being in the elevator that changed his life as it was what he did after he got out of the elevator. He decided to sue the management company and everything. And I think the litigious course of action made his life more complicated than he would have liked it to have been.
As fascinating as his story is, though, there are other stories in this story that are just terrific. For example, that word I had never run into before, elevatoring.
Elevatoring is the science of figuring out how to get people in and out of buildings on elevators. It's about moving as many people in as quickly as possible. It's about not wasting too much space on the elevator banks. As I say in the story, it's not rocket science, but it has its complications and arcana. And its practitioners are brilliant, undersung heroes.
For example, designing elevators, you have to have enough elevators to move people efficiently, but not so many that you take up space the company would like to rent out.
Right. I guess in some of the taller buildings, in the super tall skyscrapers, if you were to get everybody up to the top in a sort of conventional manner, then the entire, the bottom of the building, the first 20 stories or whatever, would be elevator banks. And so they have to come up with solutions to get the elevators to move faster, more efficiently, so that there's less space for the elevators and more space for the landlords to rent to people.
And this is one of the great breakthroughs in this art, I guess, was the idea of the sky lobby.
Yeah, the sky lobby. It was first introduced at the World Trade Center in 1973. And it's sort of like a transfer station. You take a shuttle to that station and then the elevator goes up and the local goes up and down from there. And apparently that moves bodies more efficiently.
And I think it was Conrad Hilton, the establisher of the Great Hotel chain, who said, if you have to wait longer than 30 seconds for an elevator, something is very wrong.
Yeah, people just don't like to wait. They're much more patient with planes and trains and taxis or whatever. With elevators, it's 30 seconds or you start to claim that you've been waiting for 5 minutes.
You also write a lot about the psychology of how we stand in elevators and that, in fact, you can watch camera footage and see people move themselves around like the dots on a dice. That if there are two people, they're in corners. If there are three people, they form an isosceles triangle.
Yeah, I guess standing close gives people the creeps, so they will divide the space up among themselves in an almost sort of perfect manner. It's like we've been trained in a zone defense or something from birth. We know how to space out in a space and not get too close and then not be too conspicuous about not getting close,
And there's this element within 18 inches when they say, what is that, intimate space? Is that what they call it?
Yeah, I think within 18 inches you can start to smell other people. You can pick up on their body heat, and that is generally thought to be disturbing to human beings. And of course, in a crowded elevator or like a crowded subway, you're at least that close. So it's a temporarily disturbing environment.
And interesting that crowded elevators much more acceptable in Japan than in New York.
That's what they say. They say that people tolerate closer quarters in East Asia than they do in New York. There are lots of sort of cultural tendencies in elevators, which, you know, we could talk about for hours.
Well, maybe another show. Yeah. There is, let's see if we get some listeners in on this conversation. Nick Palmgarten is our guest. He wrote Up and Then Down, which appears in the April 21st issue of The New Yorker magazine. He's with us from our bureau in New York. 800-989-8255 if you have an elevator story or question for us. Email is talk@npr.org. And Don is with us. Don calling from Howell in Michigan.
Hi, Don.
Don, you there? Don, 5 seconds. 3, 2, 1. See you, Don.
He's stuck in an elevator.
Let's see if we can go instead to Scott. Scott with us from Appleton, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Go ahead.
Questions for you. A theory of mine that I've always had is if I hold the button down of the floor that I want to go to plus the door closed button simultaneously, will I bypass other floors who are waiting?
Well, you know, it's a famous elevator hack, and it's been rumored to exist for a while, even on the internet. And this is kind of pathetic to admit, but I've written another story about that particular thing. I once wrote a story about trying it in Manhattan. I tried it in various places. It works in some places and doesn't work in others. Funny enough, none of the elevator professionals I talked to thought it was possible. So there may be some kind of conspiracy that we don't know about.
All right. Well, thank you for answering my question, but it is a possibility in some locations.
Oh, it works some places, absolutely. But
fantastic.
They won't tell you about it, though. It's a dirty little secret.
Scott, thanks very much. You do write, though, about the psychology of those controls on the elevator panel that the designers are trying to give us the illusion that we're in control of this box that hurtles us up and down.
Yeah, I guess people like control. The door close button, for example, does not work on elevators that are, you know, 20 or so years old. I mean, elevators that have been introduced in the last 20 years or so, the door closed building tends not to work. Door closed button tends not to work. So it's like a placebo. People just press it to make them feel better. And the fact is that the door eventually closes, so you think the door closed button is working, which, you know, is like a perfect placebo.
If you pray every day for rain, one of these days you're going to be right.
Exactly.
Let's go. Let's see if we can go now to Michael. Michael calling us from San Francisco.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for the program.
Thank you.
Just have a couple of, one funny story. Regarding impatience that people have on elevators, there was a time where I came in and stuck my hand in to hold the doors open, and the gentleman was evidently late for work and became visibly agitated, hit all of the buttons on for every floor, and then left in a huff. I just had to laugh out loud to myself and tell him that he needed to relax a little bit. So
that's pretty funny.
That's good stuff. One other point, and you were talking about proximity and personal space in the elevator before. I also find it kind of fun every once in a while to stand a little bit closer than people are comfortable and just watching their reactions. Because you're right, people do separate very much. And thank you very much for the program.
And then you should just talk to them, and that'll make it even worse. You know, people don't like talking in elevators, although, you know, in my building at work, people talk a lot. So
there are so many unwritten but recognized rules.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Michael. Here's an email we have from Kitty in Grand Junction, Colorado. We rode 90-some floors in Chicago, went to the bar, looked at the view, went back down. Nothing remarkable but the view. Months later, the same group rode 90-some floors in the B of A building in San Francisco. The ride was slightly bumpy, and we complained that they hadn't done as good a job designing the building as they'd done in Chicago. When the doors opened, we were greeted by the sight of the wide-eyed young receptionist on the phone saying, "Yeah, Mom, we're all okay, but it was so scary. You guessed it. We'd been in the elevator during an earthquake."
Oh,
that's pretty scary. You write about some of the scary, I guess, in a way, they're urban myths about elevators, that there is a sizable number of people who get killed every year as elevators plummet into the basement of buildings.
Yeah, elevators don't really plummet. They don't free fall. I mean, of course, it's happened. And, you know, you ask an elevator professional if there are instances of free fall, and they tend to just mention one, and it's the sort of famous elevator accident at the Empire State Building in 1945, I guess. A bomber ran into the building and severed the cables, and one of the elevators with an operator on board plummeted all the way to the bottom, 80 floors, and she survived. But generally, the accidents are, you know, there are other kinds of accidents. The elevators tend to go up rather than down because the counterweight, the thing at the other end of the car, is actually heavier than the elevator car itself. And then there are all kinds of horrible things that happen when people try to get out of elevators that are sort of stuck between floors, and then the elevator starts to move. People probably have heard some of those stories.
There's the elevator's door opened and somebody steps in and there's no elevator there.
That tends to happen with some frequency, and so I'm told, and that's a grim fate.
Here's an email from Stanley in St. Louis. My wife was stuck in an elevator for 45 minutes. The interesting, though probably not surprising, aspect was that the emergency phone in our elevator was pretty obviously connected to a call center in India.
That's true. I think some of the emergency, the elevator companies have an emergency protocol set up so that your call goes to probably in India. So I don't think that person's going to come save you, but maybe they have a mechanism in place to deploy someone else to come save you.
Another fascinating thing that you mentioned in your article, that elevators are, in a way, very much akin to teleportation.
Well, you go into an elevator in one place, and then you come out in another. It's sort of like magic. You know, it's like that door slides close, and then it opens, and there's something else there. It's like a magic trick.
It is like a magic trick. I just hadn't thought of it that way. But maybe that's the reason, I guess, we all go blank when we're in elevators and just stare sheepishly ahead. I don't know.
Well, we don't. I guess people don't like to be in elevators. So it's something that we all feel we have to endure.
We're talking about elevators, of course, with Nick Palmgarten, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Susan's on the line. Susan calling from Hickory, North Carolina.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Hickory, pretty as a postcard.
Pardon me?
Hickory, pretty as a postcard.
Yeah, it's a great place. I moved here from California, so I really enjoy it. The quietness by comparison to Los Angeles. I was working in the furniture mart in Hickory a couple of years ago, and it was a real busy weekend. I was there very early, and I got caught in the elevator, and it started to shake, and I'm claustrophobic. So when it started to shake and rattle, go up and then kind of fall down and shake, and then it stopped. A friend of mine who owned the coffee shop at the bottom of the elevator was just about due any moment to give birth to her little girl, and she went absolutely hysterical. So I wasn't scared until I heard her screaming at the top of her lungs, and it's a rotunda, so up four flights of stairs, open in the middle of the building, this huge building, I could hear her screaming, "Oh my God, Susan's trapped in the elevator." And she just wouldn't let it go. And I thought, dear Lord, she's going to go into labor and I can't help her because we were there so early. And I mean, I wasn't that high up. I was caught between like the second and third floor, but it did take them about an hour to get me out. So.
And how'd they get you out? They get you out through the hatch on top, or they wheel it down? And
the little old guys that worked there kind of started sliding a little bit down, and they got it open kind of between floors and kind of pulled me out. They used something to pry the door open and got me out. And I just spent the week at High Point Furniture Market, and I really thought about that, going up and down those elevators a million times, and everybody being real close together and, you know, from all over the world. And you're right, nobody talks. Everybody just kind of looks, and then there's all different languages spoken to at the same time. That's pretty funny.
Right.
Susan, thank you.
No problem.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can go to, this is Ross. Ross in Oklahoma City.
Hey, gentlemen, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Hey, I just thought, you know, some people might want to hear a perspective of somebody who has ridden on top of an elevator.
Yeah, cool.
Just kind of curious if your author ever had a chance to do that.
No, they wouldn't let me. You know, I kept asking all these companies if I could do that, and I had to sign all these releases just to even go into the into the machine rooms. No one would let me ride on top of the elevator, and I thought they were nuts. But then I saw one time I was in a shaft looking at the elevator going by, and I saw the counterweight, which is the thing connected to the other side. It's like
right.
A big weight, almost like a guillotine, you know, it came flying by, and you realize that if your head was sort of sticking out just a little bit, it'd be lopped right off. And so suddenly,
I was a kid when I rode on top of an elevator. I was a child. My grandfather serviced elevators, and he'd been an elevator installer, and you know, just worked in the business for years. And he was working at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater, working actually for an elevator company that just serviced the elevators there on campus. And as a kid, a couple of times he took me to work with him. And I got a chance to actually, you know, just kind of follow him around for a day. More than once, I recall riding on top of an elevator with him. And he would sort of watch the counterweights go by and just sort of making sure everything was working the way it should. And, of course, he was always very careful, you know, don't get anywhere near those pulleys over there and don't touch these cables. And don't touch this and don't touch that. So it was a little bit scary, but it was also just a real thrill, and just to be able to say, you know, every time we watch Die Hard with my kids, I say, hey, guys, I ran on top of an elevator one time, you know, and bore them with stories of, you know, stuff like that. He also used to tell me stories about when he was installing elevators, how he would sometimes on the fly at the construction site, they would have to subtly redesign the elevator to actually make it work, because the architect would say, well, we're going to put an elevator here, and it's going to look like this. And then the people actually installing it would say, well, yeah, but elevators don't really work that way. And explain to the architects and the engineers that, no, you need a second track to keep it steady, and odd little things like that. He's full of a lot of interesting stories about the elevator business. So this is kind of a walk down memory lane listening to you guys talk about elevators, because it's almost like family business for us.
Ross, thanks so much for the call.
Sure, thanks.
Bye-bye. And finally, here's an email that we have from an anonymous writer. So if romance in an airplane puts you in the Mile High Club, what do you call those who partake in an elevator?
Oh, geez, I can't say it on the air.
And that's a good thing.
I had one finally, but I don't think I could say it on the air.
Okay. We'll see if we can get an answer off the air and send it back to our anonymous writer. Nick Palmgarten, thanks very much. Nice article.
Thanks for having me.
Nick Palmgarten, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, with us today from our bureau in New York. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan. Tomorrow, the director of the HBO miniseries, John Adams, will join us. We'll also speak with John Adams' biographer, David McCullough. So be here tomorrow. This is NPR News in Washington.